Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey friends, welcome to another episode of Tennis and Bagels. We have another week of great tennis that has just ended. And there's actually, as we speak, another match between Camilla Giorgi and, what's her name? Peterson.
Yeah, Rebecca.
Rebecca Peterson. I thought he was it, but I wasn't really sure. I thought he was like, maybe I'm confusing with like some sort of like actress or something. But yeah, Rebecca Peterson. Right now, as we speak, but the biggest, most anticipated finals of the week and the weekend really have been over for quite a while now. And there was a lot of stuff to unpack this week. We almost had a repeat or almost three-peat of winners that we just talked about last week. And I'm here again with Vansh. It was almost going to be like a copy-paste of the same podcast ever again. How's it doing, man?
Yeah, doing good, dude. Another like jam-packed week with like five of events and this time we have a WTA 1000, I guess, to analyze and break down because, there were some interesting developments. And I think I learned some new things, actually, about some of these players this week compared to last week. So it feels more like an extension, but also some of these results, I think, can be relevant moving forward. So it should be fun.
Yeah. And we are going to start with the... I think it's fair to say that it was pretty much the surprise of the week. Barbora Krejcikova winning her first WTA Masters, not Masters, but WTA 1000 event. And she beat none other than Iga Świątek. And on her way, she also beat Arina Sabalenka to reach that final. So,
yeah, it was one of the most incredible runs.
Yeah, the really
to
huge
WTA 1000 that I've ever seen because. I mean, obviously, we know how great Krejcikova is. I think at one point last year in February, she was 2 in the world. And of course, we had first actually talked about her on this podcast. I remember 2 years ago in Dubai, actually, when she made the final there of the 1000. And that was her first real, I think, breakthrough on the big stage. And she lost to Garbina Muguruza, who was on that incredible run, if you remember at the time. You know, she just lost out to Naomi Osaka at the US Australian Open, had just 2 match points, but she was playing really well, Garbine. And Garbine beat her in the final. And they went on to have this nice rivalry. But then this time last year, Krejcikova was 2 in the world. She'd sort of proven herself after winning the French. And we knew she was a great doubles player, but then she had elbow surgery. Yeah. So that took her out of the game for 4 or 5 months. And, you know, she kind of came back last year, French Open, like lost first round to Diane Perry, but, you know, was just not really back yet, like was kind of working her way. And then something clicked in October and she won Tallinn and she beat Świątek in that Ostrava final, which was, in my opinion, the match of the year on the WTA side. It's the first time Świątek has ever lost in a final. So you thought there was potential here for Krejcikova to go on a big run, but I didn't expect her to beat the gauntlet of players that she did and the way she did it because she got through the first round against Arina Kamalabegu, but then she had to play Daria Kazakina. Kazakina, I remember, had beaten her earlier this year in Australia, and that's kind of a difficult matchup. Kazakina is a really crafty player. She doesn't have a big serve or a huge game, but she's really, really clever around the court and how she uses her angles and you know, when you don't have so many overwhelming weapons off the ground, like you have to be really crafty and use a lot of guile. And Krejcikova struggled a lot with that. And she was down 4 match points. So this run that we're talking about right now could have never happened. You know, we might have been sitting here talking again about how great Iga is. And we probably we'll get to her as well. But this run couldn't have happened if Krejcikova hadn't saved those 4 match points. And I think Kazakina was up 5-3 in that third set, 40-15. She double faults on the first match point, and you're thinking, uh-oh, she's feeling the pressure. She's a little tight. Then I think Krejcikova hit a forehand down the line winner, or at least forced a mistake. And then she hit another inside in winner. And then she got another double fault. And then she turned that match around. And then, as you mentioned, then she beat Sabalenka, who is the number two in the world, Australian Open champion, is on a 13-match win streak at the time. And Sabalenka goes up 6-love 3-1. She's in the most dominant phase of her life.
I did not see her match, her losing that match in any way.
There was no chance, I thought, for Krejcikova to come back. But I did notice that some of the games in that first four games of the second set, like, they were a little tight compared to the first set. It was just a total blowout for Sabalenka. But then, you know, as soon as she holds for 3-2, she's like, okay, it's just one break. The thing about Krejcikova that amazes me is the whole arsenal that she has, because she plays doubles. She's so well-rounded on the tennis court. Like, you can see how frustrating she is. I think Nick Carter of Popcorn Tennis called her a disruptor. And I think that's a good way of putting it, because you watch her play and it's like, it's not like, you know, Swiatek, like, we know what her strengths are. They're a lot more sort of obvious. Like, she has a heavy topspin forehand. You know, she defends like Djokovic style, like on the backhand. And, you know, she can just blitz through opponents. But for Krejcikova, it's more, she uses a lot of, she mixes in. She uses your pace that you give her, and she redirects so well, and she's able to hit these ridiculous angles. And because she's so skilled at the net, because she's such a good returner, when she gets in that mode where everything is just pinging off her racket, it's such smooth, easy power. So you feel like you're just sort of trapped and you're at the mercy of her redirection shots. It's a little bit like Bencic, but with a lot more, like, her shots have a lot more sting and they're really heavy, and she can create pace on her own. It's really, like, you know, her forehand is a lot more like a clay court forehand, and her backhand is like, it's a bullet. Like, that thing,
her backhand was absolutely destroying Swiatek from the back of the court. Like, there was nothing she could do. I mean, to be fair to Swiatek, she played a really poor match in that final. But yeah, like, I think the Sabalenka match was just, I was tweeting from the Tennis and Bagels account, and I said that, like, well, Sabalenka looked so, like, in tune with her own game. Like, she looked like she was not going to lose. She looked so confident. And then all of a sudden, like, after the 3-1, as you mentioned, like, she just kind of started getting frustrated. And obviously, Krejcikova started playing really well. But then it just felt like an immediate jinx. I was like, well, that's the commentator's curse.
Yeah, that's like, what we love about the game. Yeah. that's what we love, is, like, it's never over to the last point. We'll get to that with another final as well, with Nori and Alcaraz later. But, you know, 6-love 3-1, and I'm thinking, okay, like, Sabalenka is not playing bad. That was an excellent return game to get the break back. But then they go to the tiebreak, and then Sabalenka double faults twice, and that's a killer. You know, you can't do that in a tiebreak and then expect to come through in a situation like that. I still thought maybe there's a chance Sabalenka would regroup in the third. Didn't happen. Krejcikova was on top of every single point. Sabalenka was a little deflated, kind of understandable, because when Krejcikova hits her peak level, it's scary. It's like top three or four on the WTA. It's like really, really insane, actually, especially on a fast court, because it just feels like it's happening so fast. And I think also another thing, her serve is pretty underrated. Like, she's able to hit the spots. Yeah, Krejcikova. Yeah. You know, if you had watched that final against Swiatek, Swiatek was not having good success, especially off the second serve. We know how strong she is at returning second serve. I mean, she breaks so often, almost 50% of the time. Against Krejcikova, it didn't really happen. And Swiatek was not able to problem solve her way into the match back. And then I thought she was going to beat Pegula because this is the fifth time in WTA history that someone has beaten world number 3, 2, and 1 in the same week. And before that, it's like Serena, Venus, you know, like Henin, like it's really, really rare. I have, you know, like 1999 Graf. Yeah, it's basically Graf, Serena, Venus, and then Sabalenka last year at the WTA finals, right? Not Henin. Sabalenka last year at the WTA finals, but Sabalenka didn't end up winning. She lost to Garcia in the final.
Yeah.
But she beat 3-2-1 on the way. But here, I knew she was going to beat Pegula. She had a little bit of a hiccup in the second set and then bageled her in the third. So now you're thinking, okay, here we go. Iga versus Barbora for the final.
Is it going to be a repeat of last year's?
Yeah. And it's interesting because they played some close matches in the past. I remember in 2021 in Rome, they played a three-setter and Krejcikova saved. Krejcikova had 2 match points, but Swiatek ended up winning that match, and then she double bageled Pliskova in the final, won Rome. And that was, you know, that was a turning point, because that match was really difficult for her. But she got through that.
Yeah.
And then she lost the Ostrava final, obviously, from a setup. But going into this one, I also really, you know, I thought we were going to get a close match. I didn't expect the scoreline that we got.
Yeah,
and I think some of the reason.
Yeah, it's like Świątek also, I'm not sure if I already mentioned this, but she hit 10 winners to 27 unforced errors.
Yeah,
in this match.
It was not a good match from her. Yeah. I thought mentally as well. I think that's what surprised me more than anything because, you know, she went down an early break. She lost her serve from 40-15 up.
Yeah.
And Krejcikova hit two beautiful backhand winners. And now you're thinking, okay, but Świątek has to respond. And she did, to her credit. She actually did. She got it to 4-all.
Yeah,
they broke each other twice, and it was getting harder for each player to hold their serve. But then I just thought that Iga didn't have the same patience that she normally has in these rhythmic baseline exchanges, and she was trying to pull the trigger way too early.
Yeah, and I think but at the same time, like as this was happening, the one thing that I was seeing like was that she just couldn't get the ball in play. She was making like weird errors that she wouldn't normally do. So I'm not sure if it's like the discrepancy of like her finally finding some sort of bad day after like so many bagels and like breadsticks.
Yeah, and like, you know, that's one thing that I mentioned on Twitter actually is that it's a little bit of an interesting dichotomy because yes, she's bageling and breadsticking the likes of Kazakina and Goff and you know, even Samsonova and other, you know, really good players like in the top 15 and former Slam finalists. She's doing that on a regular basis. But then her last three losses have been kind of comprehensive. Like she lost to Pegula at the United Cup.
Yeah.
That was 2-2. She lost to Rybakina. That was, you know, fairly like it was straight sets. It was, you know, it didn't go to a third and it felt kind of inevitable. And then on a fast court. And then this one, you know, was 4-2, but she looked kind of discouraged to me. Like she didn't really like have that second gear. And I think some of that is because she's so used to like always being ahead on the score. And she plays so quick in between points as well. Like you watch her, it's like almost like she's playing with a timer. And
she never took the time to be a little bit more frustrated and just like take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Times.
And I do want to mention that she was a little under the weather. I think that's important to note because when you're feeling a little sick, it can be like kind of hard to like regroup, focus, like get your tactics right. And it's really difficult also to win Doha and Dubai. So I empathize with her a little bit because I think that's only been done twice in history. Like Hingis in 2001 and Henin in 2007 are the only two to have ever done it. Not even Serena, Venus. So it's a really difficult turnaround because like Doha is a lot slower and then Dubai is like, you know, pretty fast. Like it's,
it did feel really fast. Like, I mean, the one thing that Krejcikova was doing that I think was, I don't want to say a concern to Świątek because she probably already knows that her serve isn't like her biggest, the biggest weapon on tour. But like the way that Krejcikova was just standing inside of the baseline and just kind of blocking it back so much, and especially off of the backhand side. Like the forehand started a little bit slow for her, I suppose. And the second set, it really picked it up. But like the backhand was just firing like for an entire match, just like winner after winner.
I love her backhand. I love it because she has that really short take back.
Yeah, it was so good. It's like it's probably like a really good result of playing so much doubles because the return has to be like that, and like the way that she got to be like more pacey. And it's just like a really good combination of like the skills of a singles player and a doubles player together. I feel like if you're just a doubles player, you wouldn't be able to have this much consistency. And if you're a singles player, you end up like maybe just kind of taking your time a bit more. But like I think
she's a Hall of Fame lock because you mentioned the doubles. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
She's won 10 majors in doubles, 7 majors in regular doubles, and then 3 in mixed, and all with really good partners. And like she and Siniakova, like pretty much every week they win, like every major event that they're playing now, they're winning. They won
You're always going to see on Twitter the picture of them like jumping with the trophy.
I mean, and they're like, I don't think anyone else is, any other doubles pair is even close to them, but now she has a 1000, she has a French Open, she has a 500, she has all these other titles. And I'd be shocked if she's not in the top 8, like by the end of the year. Maybe even top 5. I think she's a top 5 caliber player when she's playing well. But another thing, you know, you're so right about the returns.
Yeah.
Because guess what? Świątek made her first serve percentage was 69%.
Mm-hmm.
She won 57% of the points.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that, like, you know, people talk about Świątek's second serve, and I get why they're doing that because you see like players can, you know, certain players like a Rybakina, Sabalenka and stuff, like they can go at it on a fast court and rush Iga, especially on her forehand. I get that. But if her first serve is going in 70% of the time, she should be winning more of those points.
Yeah.
So I think her first serve effectiveness is the main thing that I think like she can improve, because if you think about it on the WTA, like most people's second serve, pretty attackable. Like it's not like, you know, I mean, you can look at a Pegula, you can look at other players. It feels like the second serve, like, you know, if your first serve percentage is low, like you're going to have to defend. And I think she actually does a decent job in most matches keeping her second serve points one high, because she defends like Djokovic, like on her backhand.
Yeah, yeah.
So because of that, it's like pretty hard to like actually pin her back. But because there's not much difference between her first and second serve, I feel like that's where she gets dominated in that serve return dynamic. Yeah, because you can return, but if Krejcikova's serving well and then she's returning well, it's a nightmare. And yeah, like I just didn't think she did enough. I think one chance that Swiatek had was in the beginning of the second set. Yeah. It was 1-2, 15-40. She had two break points. From there, Krejcikova won five games in a row.
Yeah.
And that's where I felt like if Swiatek had gotten the break there, we could have seen maybe a three-setter. But what happened is that because, you know, those chances were rare, and when she was missing them, she was getting really frustrated. She was looking at her box. She was, you know, like she didn't have that sort of calmness to reset, and she didn't play the right shot. At 30-40, she went for broke on a backhand that if she just used her athleticism and shot tolerance, she might have won the point and then broken for 3-1. But she couldn't control the shot, and she kind of had, she probably wants that point back looking back. But after that, I thought Krejcikova was just exceptional. Like,
It's one of those things, like one of those terrible days in which, like, not only your game is not really working, but like Krejcikova's game was just clicking so well. Like, it was only at some point it became just a matter of time. And obviously, like, if it's tennis, right? And I'm not sure if we talked about this like before or after we started the recording, but you know, it's like one of the things about tennis, like, as soon as you think it's over, well, it's not over until it's over. So like if Swiatek just kept playing, maybe Krejcikova's level would drop. It was always a possibility, but it's just she closed it out beautifully. So I think she served it 2-15 or to love to finish the match.
Oh yeah, and she finished it with a beautiful inside in forehand. She has such good footwork on her backhand side in general, on the outside. Like she's able to just, you know, run around her backhand and hit really sharp inside in forehands. I mentioned that's how she saved one of those match points against Kazakhin. That was an inside in forehand winner. And it's just so smooth. It's like just watching, it's like smooth as silk. You know, you watch her play and she's so calm and composed. I feel like she's not talked about nearly as enough. She doesn't get like the big court assignments in a lot of these slams. She's often playing like just kind of going under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
But when she gets deep into an event, like, just watch out, because now she beat four top 10 players here. And now her ranking is going to go up. Yeah. And she's formidable on all surfaces. I even think there's a chance she might be able to go really deep at Wimbledon. Because we mentioned, the other thing that she did really well, which is a little bit out of the Barty playbook, used the backhand slice.
Yeah,
and
I saw it a few times.
And did a kind of, and it was kind of deliberate and very offensive-minded, because she would use that slice, hit it short, low, and forced Swiatek to hit up on her backhand, which is not nearly as comfortable of a shot for her. It'll be less precise, and then Krejcikova has the next shot, usually a forehand, but even the backhand that she can just crush for a winner.
Yeah, I think I love when players like Serena Williams came before, and obviously Serena Williams isn't necessarily comparable to Ash Barty, but Barty also did like her kind of fair share of dominance on tour before she decided to retire. But like when players like that, they just kind of show up and they just do something really well. I think it's just natural that other players would try to like add it to their arsenal. Like, for example, Serena Williams's power and big serve, it was something that like got assimilated for a lot of players.
It kind of revolutionized the game.
Yeah.
Serena's power and Venus as well.
Exactly.
And then you had that whole wave of like Capriati, Davenport. And I think we're kind of seeing that a little bit now with the first strike power tennis with Sabalenka, Rybakina, Samsonova. And then you have sort of this group of the variety people.
It's like we have the Andreescus and Andreescu,
Bencic, Barty. I think you even put like a Mukova in there.
Yeah, she's Mukova is really good at it.
Crafty player as well. Like, you know, Petra Martic on a good day. Like, these are all players who I think can disrupt people's rhythm. And that's the key thing.
And then obviously, like a Krejcikova has pretty much all the shots in the book.
Yeah.
So
I mean, she's pretty formidable. So it was a well deserved triumph for Krejcikova in the end, and I think Iga can be proud of her 2 weeks as well, because she, I mean, destroyed so many people along the way, and for she made another final after winning, and she pretty much defended her points from last year. I think that was the big thing, is can she defend all those points and have that same aura? And I think she still does. It's just that this kind of exposed a few things, and in a way it's kind of good because she's forcing the competition like around her to elevate, and that's what we're seeing with Krejcikova, Rybakina, now players like that. Like, it's taking something different to beat Swiatek. If you just play her from the baseline and you just you play into her hands, it's not going to work. So I think this is good for the WTA that we have like this rivalry. I think, like, along with Djokovic and Alcaraz, for me this might be the rivalry on the women's side, because I just think the contrast is so good. It's like we didn't get Barty and Swiatek, unfortunately, but I think if we can get more of these matches, I think Iga, Sabalenka, Iga, Krejcikova, those are the two, I think, for me, that if we can get them to play four or five times or something this year, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Now, when it gets to the clay, I think Iga is a step above. I really do, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing is, like, Krejcikova did win Roland Garros once. Swiatek wasn't playing, like, her best and whatnot, but, like, I do want to see them both playing, going at each other at Roland Garros. I think it could be a, not sure if we're headed towards the final. I think things are more likely.
Could happen any round because of the ranking. But
yeah, not so much, because, like, now she's, like, ranked number 30, and by the time that Roland Garros hits on, I think she's going to be seated. But it could still happen in, like, a third round or something like that. But I would still love to watch them both playing each other at RG. I think it's going to be a really good clay match. And it's going to be really good.
See how Krejcikova builds on this, because she was 30, like you mentioned. Now she's 16.
Yeah.
And if she keeps this level up, again, I don't think there's no reason why she shouldn't be in.
Maybe she's gonna be able to avoid Swiatek up to at least the quarterfinals.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting because she does play a lot of doubles. So I'm curious to see if she does, like, scale back a little bit in some of these other events and focuses on singles. Because either way, like, she's kind of set, because like Hall of Fame lock, like I said, like can play all three disciplines really, really well. Yeah, she's such a good sport too. Like, I was watching the trophy ceremony. She had such nice things to say about, you know, Iga, vice versa. Yeah. I think this is just a good rivalry. And now they split their last four. It's 2-2. And I think Krejcikova leads 2-1 on hard and 1-0 on clay for Iga.
Yeah, so I hope that she stays healthy and she climbs up the rankings a bit more, so that we can just see like a good... It could be even like a three-way rivalry, right? It's like a Krejcikova, Swiatek, Sabalenka, whoever wants to drop in the mix. But so far, those three are like the players.
Yeah, and recency bias, that loss for Sabalenka now, it doesn't look nearly as bad. And she still got to the quarters.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, a little bit of a dip is kind of inevitable anyway after winning a slam. So I'm not worried about Sabalenka either.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, like, recency bias does kind of take its place. Like, when you talk about Krejcikova, is definitely like one of the must-see, like, this year. Like, she's definitely playing good tennis. It remains to be seen, like, whether she's going to be there as well. But, like, at least, like, a Sabalenka, Swiatek, I think we're pretty confident they're going to remain powerhouses throughout the year. Like, at least we hope. We think that it's going to happen, but we do have to, like, hope that this is going to... They're going to remain healthy. Nobody's going to have, like, a day yips again. Like, Sabalenka is not going to hit, like, another 18 double faults in the match. Yeah.
Yeah. And Krejcikova, it's kind of no guarantee, because she's still going to have to get through some tough rounds too.
Exactly.
Get to these latter stages, and she almost lost to Kazakina, like, probably should have. And then, at the Australian Open this year, she played Pegula, and Pegula beat her in the fourth round. And I just thought, like, I think that's when I started feeling good about Krejcikova, like, oh, she could do something big this year, even though she lost that match, like, fairly decisively. Yeah, after a close first set, I was like, okay, she's not quite at her best right now. Like, still kind of coming back from the elbow, a few ups and downs. Like, she didn't really carry over that form from October, like in that matchup specifically. But then I saw that when she's at her best, there's not really that much, like, because Pegula is such a consistent player, like, her floor and her ceiling are, like, not that different.
Yeah.
Whereas I saw for Krejcikova.
Yeah, it's like Krejcikova's ceiling is really high, and it's hard to assess her floor, actually, because, like, she had the elbow surgery, and, like, now she's kind of been up and down. So, like, when she gets to, like, a regular consistent level, I think that's when we're going to see, okay, like, this is where she stands on, like, in when she's not necessarily playing at her best. So I think we're going to have to
wait. I think her slam results were pretty decent after the French Open. She got to the fourth round of Wimbledon, lost to Barty. Barty ended up winning.
Yeah.
She lost in the quarters to Sabalenka. No shame there. lost in the quarters of Australia to Madison Keys, but had some problems in the heat. So she was still playing like a top eight player, pretty much. And then like also won more titles after the French. So yeah, I think this is good, pretty good overall. I think there were some walkovers in this tournament. Pliskova was supposed to play Iga in the quarters. Didn't happen because Krejcikova got sick.
Pliskova got sick.
What am I saying? Yeah. Pliskova got sick, so she withdrew, and then Iga was in the semis, and then Rybakina pulled out as well. So,
Yeah, I do have a feeling. Well, I guess it is a 1,000 event, but I do wonder how much those players are really trying to keep themselves healthy for the Sunshine Double at this point.
Yeah, it was a weird quarterfinal day because we only had like two quarterfinals out of four, but then. But then, it kind of makes sense because there was definitely something like floating in the air. Wait, did I say that Rybakina?
Yeah, you did.
Hold out? No. It wasn't Rybakina. I got that wrong. It was Mukova.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mukova has been up and down. Maybe she's kind of not.
Was worrying because she withdrew with an abdominal injury and she's been dealing with that for the last 2 years. And that's kind of the reason why her ranking is where it's at.
Yeah,
because I think she's actually like top 20 material as well.
Exactly, same here.
But so hopefully she gets healthy because she beat Bencic in the fourth round and then had to pull out, and we would have seen her against Pegula. Yeah.
It's been said that this is essentially the story of her career so far. Like this past few years have been playing good matches, gets injured. Playing good matches, gets.
Oh, and Rybakina did also withdraw. Actually, but that was in the fourth round against Goff.
Mm.
And Goff and Iga did play each other in the semifinals again. And while I thought this was a little bit better from Goff, I still thought her forehand broke down a bit too much. And I think that's when I kind of thought that Krejcikova had a chance, was in the final, because I saw the semis of Iga and Coco, and I was like, Iga didn't play a great match, but she still ended up winning 4-2. And I just thought, like, her level will need to be higher in the final.
Yeah.
And it didn't.
I guess it was probably lower.
And I think Iga also got a withdrawal in the quarter, so that's kind of tough.
She did. She got another withdrawal again. Like it was the second week in a row that she gets to a final without
because
having
last
to
year
play
was
fewer matches.
Bencic that withdrew, and then this year was last week it was Bencic in Doha, and this week it was Pliskova. Doesn't really take much away because she still got the points. I think she probably would have won those matches, but
if we're moving on, but still in the same region of the world, we had another really inspiring run. Andy Murray got back into a final for the first time since I think June last year.
We gotta talk about that because his year so far has been really quite something. Every single match of his has gone the distance. It's been exhilarating. It's been down to the wire in three of the nine matches he's played so far this year. He's had to save match points.
Yeah.
He's basically been on court every match for over 3 hours. It's been a whole Murray coaster, as our friends at Murray Musing likes to call it. And it's just like, it's just almost inevitable that these matches are going to a third set, this thing. But I'm so encouraged by his level of play and his fitness, because I feel like in the off season he worked so hard. Probably trained much harder than ever before. And he was disappointed with his year last year because, yes, he got to those two finals in Stuttgart and one in Sydney in the beginning of the year. He lost to Karatsev, and then in the Stuttgart final, he lost to Berrettini.
Berrettini in three.
Yeah, and he kind of hurt his abdominal after the second set, which he won, and he had all the momentum. So I felt like that was unfortunate that he didn't win a title, and then this year. He's really like hitting the ball better. I think he's hitting his forehand a little harder, which is really important for him.
Yeah.
He's hitting the backhand down the line more. He's defending well. And obviously he still has limitations because metal hip and changing directions and return. Like, it's never going to be old Andy Murray, but I still feel like he's giving us so much enough vintage stuff. I mean, the first week of the Australian Open, it was all Andy, basically, like in terms of storylines and, drama and stuff like that. And in this match, he saved two match points right away, or three actually, against Sonego.
Yeah, three match points. I think 2-1 his serve. All of them on his serve, actually. He served all of them on his serve. He was down 15-40 and then served an ad serve with, I think, an ace.
Yes, and so that was clutch. And then he got through that. And then then the match against Zverev. I watched that one, and I thought Zverev was playing good. I thought this was the first time Zverev actually looked like back, like close to his best, like since the French Open, since he basically tore his ankle against Nadal. I was like, okay, this is legit. If Andy wins this, like, this is significant, because like Zverev was playing, you know, pretty well. Like, especially like he picked up his level, like in the second set, he won 6-2. He had a break point in the beginning of the third, and that's where Andy like dictated with his forehand, and he took it to Sasha, because otherwise he might have been in trouble. Like Zverev, the way he was serving and playing, I thought if he broke there, he probably would have come through. But Andy was again, like, he withstood that, and then he closed that out 7-5 in the third, and then he played another three setter against Alexander Muller.
Yeah,
and lost the first set, but then the next two were pretty like decisive.
It was a 6-1, 6-2, and that was after he lost that first set, I think.
And he was up a break in the first set as well. He was up 2-0, 30-0.
I think that's when he finally, I think something clicked differently, like in his head, on like how he's supposed to be playing, because he was very used to, like, back when his was playing, like before the metal hip. One of the things that Murray was doing so much was just kind of staying in his points, kind of like massaging the ball back, especially with his forehand. And sometimes he would counter punch, but something was missing, obviously, like nowadays, like he doesn't have that. But like after he lost the first set to Muller, that he lost, that he was from up a break in the first set, I think it just kind of clicked. It's just like, hey, I gotta do something different, and just kind of like gotta pick it up on the aggressiveness. And that's essentially what he did. And that was one of the best levels I've seen from Andy Murray, like in terms of like the way that he's supposed to be playing a match. Ever since like he's come back, I guess, from the surgery.
I think you're so right about those last two sets, because it's like he just went like, yeah, this is it. Like I can't play like this, like the way I did in the first set, and now I'm just gonna play all out aggression.
Yeah.
And like I have one of the best backhands on tour. I have a good first serve when it goes in. And I can move the ball around the court with my forehand. Yes, it's not like the most powerful forehand. It's not going to do a ton of damage, but I can massage it around the court nicely. Yeah. And he did that to great effect. And it was clinical. It was efficient. And he knew his level was higher than Muller. So that was a really good match for him going into the semis against Zverev. The other thing he did so well is I loved how he was returning. Because against Zverev, he was blocking a lot of returns, like chipping them and forcing Zverev to come in his least favorite part of the court, the net. Yeah. And that's where I felt like Andy was much more superior, because he can, like, with his IQ, because he can use his backhand slice, he can like get Zverev like hitting these awkward forehands where he's having to like stay really low and like dig those low ones out, or like push him behind the baseline. And I was like, because on paper, like, he's not supposed to be winning this match with a metal hip, right? But like, because of his good like experience, like match experience all these years, and his like guile and like craftiness around the court, and just like a better IQ overall, he won. And I was like, that was something big, because like, and he didn't just fall apart. Like after that, then he beat Lehechka and he bageled him in the first set, loses the second, and you're thinking, oh my goodness, here we go again. And then Lehechka's up 5-4, 40-love. And to be honest, I do think like Lehechka will have some regrets a little bit, but I do think it was also just
maybe
like nerves trying to get to the final.
About that, he was playing a lot, like he was in the zone, like that level of tennis he was playing was unreal. It was Murray was not playing bad. I think that's the thing that we kind of have to understand. Right? It's just like Lehechka was just ridiculous. He was getting to every ball. He was making his forehand like to every corner, like close to the lines. And then we got to 40 love. I think he just kind of like crushed the weight of like, okay, I'm going to finish this match. And then he just made like a few poor decisions, played a couple bad shots. And then all of a sudden he's just like started like looking like a human being. Just like
it went from 40 love to breakpoint in a flash.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew like, okay, this is where Andy like might win it again.
I was looking at this and I was thinking, there's no way Andy wins this one. And I was like, is he going to do this? And then at the end of the day, he did. I think it was in a tiebreak, right?
Yeah, and in the tiebreak, it wasn't straightforward. Like it was, you know, it was a well played tie. It was 8-6, And Lehechka actually saved a match point. Like, you know, he hit some good shots. Like, he didn't, like, totally collapse, like, to his credit. Like, it was a tight tiebreak as well. And, like, Lehechka, like, I think he's, like, top 25, like, worthy, like, very soon, because he's had some really big wins. He got to the quarters of Australia. He beat Nori, beat Felix, beat Choric.
Yeah.
And then in, yeah. And then before that, he beat Zverev in the United Cup. And, yeah. And he played Fritz. And, like, I just think he's... And he got to the next gen finals final last year.
Mm,
yeah. So that event has proven to do big things for players.
Yeah.
So
it's
wow. And then I do you remember what happened on the match point with the with Murray in that match? Was it a some kind of a lob winner?
Oh, was it? I don't think it was a lob winner.
Oh, okay. But, no. That's how Medvedev finished the
final. Yeah, that was how Medvedev did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was maybe a passing shot, something like that. But
yeah, yes.
Yeah.
I know what it was. It was a serve and volley error by Lehechka.
Oh, okay, just, yeah. Just sailed that's wide. True. Yeah.
Like it was a good play, but he just missed the volley wide.
Yeah.
And then Andy just looked at his box and
yeah exactly. I remember that's the only thing I remember. Like Andy just in the back of the court is like screaming at his like box.
Yeah.
But yeah, like
That was amazing that he was able to save win two matches after saving match points in the same week.
Yeah.
Like at this stage in his career. And then go up against Medvedev in the final.
Which arguably he could have probably taken that a little longer. I think hadn't he played so much in the week, he was a little bit fresher. I think he would have been able to take the still at least a third set.
Yeah,
I think it ran out.
It was certainly not super one-sided because he did break back in the second. And then he lost a serve from 4-0, 40-15, which, yeah, at that point was kind of a killer.
Yeah.
And then, like, Medvedev, then he served it out with a lob winner, but he got it to deuce Andy, and then...
Yeah. I think he had a break point in that game as well, I think.
Yeah, it was 40-30, and then deuce, and then, like, I think add in, and then deuce again, and then... Like, so Medvedev had to work, and I think in the first set he was out double break, and then Andy got one of those breaks back.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, the Medvedev kind of always looked to be the better player in that match, like a bit more consistent.
And you would expect that. I mean, because they have kind of similar styles, like, and similar kind of career trajectories in some ways as well, like both winning the US Open when they were 25 and both beating Djokovic in the final, different stages and versions of Djokovic, but. And then you know they both kind of like with their forehand is not really their big strength. It's more they rely on their backhand, they rely on their return. It's very interesting actually. And then like Murray made the comment afterwards of like how much he loves watching Medvedev play. And then Medvedev was like, I got so scared when I had those match points. I thought you know Andy was going to come back and then because like he's been doing all week, it was just good vibes that whole final I think. And I mean I expected Medvedev to win going into it. And he didn't have like a super easy week because I thought Felix, to his credit, he actually made some adjustments when he played him in the semis.
It was scary because like we were watching this like and me and my peers and it was just he started the match almost exactly not exactly the same way as he did like last week. He decided to stay back.
Yeah.
But like he was doing something that it was very common of him like back 2 years ago ish when he was just kind of. Putting forehands inside out to the backhand, just kind of staying in this rally with like no real intention to his shots. That's kind of what he felt. And like, to be fair, it's probably understandable to the fact that like he just lost kind of pretty badly to Medvedev last week, and just kind of trying to figure out like how the heck do I play this guy? But I think the adjustment.
I think he changed a few things in the second set, which I thought was encouraging. Yes, he didn't win. He had two set points.
He didn't
take that set, but I thought when he went down a break, he started using his backhand slice and he started hitting it better than I'd seen it before. So he would hit that slice cross court a little bit lower, draw Medvedev in, and then he also hit like a slice down the line. And then like it was kind of low, awkward, kind of forcing Medvedev in. You know, Medvedev's probably going to hit something short with that forehand that he has. And then Felix just went on the attack and then he broke back.
I think that was like,
that is what Federer did so well. That is like what, if you watch the O'Connell highlights, O'Connell versus Medvedev, O'Connell is a guy with a one-handed backhand who drives some of his backhands and he slices it quite a bit. And then he loves to serve and volley.
Yeah.
And he started doing that. And then next thing you know, he was up 5-4 in the third set and he won the second. And it's like I'm not saying Medvedev is like gonna, like, because Medvedev adjusted and he did like find a way and he won that match.
Yeah.
And like he did adjust his return position. But the thing is, O'Connell made him adjust his return position. So he made him think and he made him play a different way. And I think Medvedev kind of had to do that against Felix as well.
Yeah. And the one thing that I found Felix was doing, like in terms of giving praise to Felix, is that, well, he was problem solving. He made crazy adjustments in that match, like from like being more like of a loopy forehand. Like, I think the way that he played against Davidovich Fokina was the way that he should have played this entire match. Like, just really flatten it out, his forehand, like just kind of like going more on the aggression, because Felix has more firepower than Medvedev. He can crush the forehand. He has a lot more easy power than Medvedev does, especially from the forehand side. The backhand, I think, will still give more.
The technique, it's heavy. Yeah.
It's, and like he runs around it. Yeah, he runs around his forehand so well. And he plays well at the net as well. So like, I think he was playing really well. And I think that was what he was doing was what he should do. He should definitely dictate points and not necessarily fall into the trap of like trading with Medvedev. Because
no, he's going to lose that battle.
Exactly. And 9 out of 10 players are going to lose that match against Medvedev. It's just going to be like, oh, okay, I'm
That's where Medvedev, I think, has the big edge in this matchup. It's the shot tolerance difference. It's those rhythmic exchanges. I think Felix gets a little bit too sort of robotic. But then when he starts using his all-court game, then he can give Medvedev problems. Like, remember the match in Australia where he was 2 sets to level up and then like he had a match point and it went down to like 7-5 in the fifth, but like he still had to make Medvedev, you know, play a ridiculous level.
Yeah.
So, even though the head-to-head is 6-0, I do feel like maybe, you know, I'd be surprised if Felix like doesn't get a win over Medvedev at some point. Like, I just think, you know, I just think his all-court game is too good to like never have a win, you know?
Yeah, and he can work out. Like 10-0. Yeah. And he can work out like the differences like in the game, like problem solving. I think he problem solved really well. And honestly, to be fair, that was the first time that I saw Felix as frustrated on court. I think he got a ball abuse warning, which I've never seen.
Oh, really?
I've never seen him getting any warning like ever. And he was clearly very upset about the fact that he was not winning a few rounds.
I kind of like that for him, you know, because he's so stoic. I feel like he just like bottles it all in. Gil Gross was talking about this.
Yeah.
And he just like kind of keeps it all in his head and like doesn't let any of it out. Yeah. I think it's healthy to do it once in a while.
Exactly. And the other thing that he did well, which helped, I think it helped him as well, it was the fact that he started shouting, come on, like when he was winning a few more points and just pumping himself up. I think it might have helped him just kind of like realize that, hey, I am a top 10 player. I should be giving this guy more trouble than losing 6-2, 6-2, right?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I think that's what happened. And I think that was props to both players for playing like a good match and Medvedev for Medvedeving it out. And Felix for trying to problem solve in a matchup that is not really favorable for him at all. So.
No, it's not. Yeah. And now that's back-to-back titles for Medvedev. He's at 17 overall. He's got... like he's literally one of those is like winning every hardcore title like once. He's kind of like just like it would be the most iconic thing if he just like literally won every single title that's on a hardcore at some point in his career. Because he doesn't come back to the same place. He kind of just wants to go to a different city and like win there. And then like he just kind of he goes on these like little rolls. But I just wonder if he'll be able to sustain it this week in Dubai. Like I could see him maybe getting to the semis and then.
Yeah,
like playing Djokovic, but I just like because Indian Wells is coming up. I'm not sure, you know, that's a good surface for him because it's you know, it doesn't really reward flat hitting. Like it's favorable to players who hit with more topspin. It's more like a clay court. It's very slow, gritty. The ball travels fast through the air, and it's high bouncing and jumpy. So those conditions are not like Rotterdam or Doha. But I do think Medvedev is good enough, even on a clay court, where he should be getting to fourth round or quarterfinals regularly. Actually,
yeah.
So if he believes in himself, right?
Do you see Medvedev ever winning Indian Wells and Miami?
No, but I could see him. Yeah. I could see him in a semifinal or even a final, just because, I was talking about it with Andy Murray. Like Murray's never really had success there, but he did make the final in 2009, and he lost to Nadal there, but he beat Federer, and you know he's had like some runs to the semis, and like Djokovic isn't going to be in the draw at Indian Wells. Alcaraz is kind of a question mark. Nadal is not playing. So, like, you know, we'll see. Like, it's still going to, like, if he just does the basics, which is serve well and cover the court well and keep himself, like, not lose it mentally. Like, because I think in 2021, he was up 6-4, 4-1 double break on Dimitrov in the fourth round. And in that draw, like, it was Nori, Basilashvili, like, Schwartzman. Like, that was a good chance for him to go, like, pretty far.
Yeah.
But yeah, it kind of depends. Like, it wouldn't shock me if he's in the semi. I think Miami is probably better for him.
Yeah.
Because he's made the quarterfinals there twice. And last year he had the hernia thing. And
yeah,
he made
true.
The quarters.
And
So yeah, like Medvedev is on a roll, but I'm not going to like project anything like super crazy. Like I do think he's more confident than he was.
Yeah, I think so too. Especially like last year, the entire of last year, I think he's been playing better this year alone and just couple of months than he played.
He mentioned something interesting after the match. He mentioned the balls and he said that they're really slow and he doesn't like how slow it is. And he says that people are having shoulder problems, wrist pain, and elbow issues and arm problems because of how slow the balls are. And he mentioned like Tsitsipas, the shoulder, like Runa with his wrist, stuff like that. He kind of attributed it to that. And he said that he was feeling some wrist pain before he stepped on the court against Korda at the Australian Open.
Yeah.
And he's like, now that I won this tournament, I can say that. But yeah, just something interesting because they changed the balls around a lot. And he still ended up winning. But yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that, because I've seen him playing at the net in Doha, and I thought he did pretty well. Like, I think he chose good moments last year. I think
when he comes in on his own terms, and when he's really feeling it, like, you know, tactically, feels like he's in a good position with the scoreboard as well.
Yeah.
Then he can actually pull off some difficult volleys because he can like manipulate his technique. It's not like a very good technique, but he can like kind of like, you know, finesse it a little bit.
Yeah, he knows what to do. And as you said, like on his terms, he's sort of like is expecting a little bit better. So like he's not necessarily caught by surprise by it. But do you think that this could be a good solution for him to try and at least like make a deeper run in Indian Wells? Try to like come to the net more.
I think he's going to have to like play around with his strategy a little bit, because if he's playing someone who's like really heavy and who stands really far back, then like he can serve in volley. I think he has that in his toolbox. The other thing is he's gonna have to counter players serving in volley against him, because some players are just better at doing that than others. Like there's some players you just know they're not going to serve in volley, but like a Maxime Cressy or like a O'Connell or like a like I guess a Tsitsipas now, or like Hurkacz. I feel like he's going to have a lot of success still. Like Medvedev is still going to be a really good top eight player. But I just, like there might be still some matchups that are just like not going to go well for him. So I'm curious to see those matchups again. Like, because now that he's more confident, he's won two titles, maybe he will adjust.
Yeah.
And he will find solutions.
I really want to see Medvedev back into like at least top five, if not top three in the world. I think it would be really interesting to see that fire back in him, to see if like he can test himself, like still be the best player in the world. I'm not sure if he can go back to number one, but I think he can at least like believe in that. They'll make good matches. So yeah, I'm all down for that.
I would be surprised if he got to number one again.
Yeah, me too. I just don't think he has the all surface game that he would need to do that. He would need to dominate way too much on hard courts, and that's not really much of a possibility, honestly, like with the landscape right now. So,
but so that was interesting to see tactically him play against Murray and in Doha, but I guess we want to shift over a little bit to the South American clay, the continuation of, you know, Buenos Aires, Córdoba, and
speaking of players with all surface versatility.
Yeah. Speaking of someone with a pretty well-rounded game himself, at 19 years of age, Carlos Alcaraz, the number one seed there. And it was kind of the similar type of draw of last week and him and Nori in the final again. But I do think in this tournament, Alcaraz was having a little bit more of a trouble adjusting to, you know, I guess just winning the title last week. Like, expectations were just maybe higher. And I think he was just a little bit more scratchy in some of his matches this week. He like didn't start well in a lot of them. He was not really, his backhand wasn't really there for him in some big moments. And he still pulled off some incredible, unbelievable highlight reel shots, some insane moments where he just pulled off like 5, 6, 7 games in a row, and there was nothing his opponent could really do. But he just had a lot more depths. Like, he dropped his serve a lot more. In his first match, he played someone who was ranked outside the top 500. And he quickly went down left too. And then he had to work pretty hard. And he got up 6-4, 5-3, and then there was a rain delay, which is so frustrating. Imagine having a rain delay at like 5-3 in the second set, and then just like continuing and having to play two more games the next day. And then from there on, he played like every day. There was this one match against Fognini that he played the next round. And Fognini, as you know, like on clay, he's a little bit more kind of erratic these days, like mentally as well, and just like not kind of the same player he was 4 or 5 years ago when he was beating Nadal. But he can still bring that level.
Fognini is a player that you should always be a little scared to see him in the
day. Yeah. and like, you know, Fognini, like, he was in this match and he was like really taking advantage of some of Alcaraz's dips. He won the first set. There were some incredible highlight shots from both. Like, Fognini was holding his own in the highlight, you know, shots department. And he can take the ball. Does that. He's dangerous. He's made the finals of Rio before. And then so Alcaraz had to scrape out of that. It wasn't pretty. He had to win ugly. It was 6-7, 6-2, 6-4. And then he played Lajovic again, and that was kind of ropey as well. But then we get to the semis and the final. And that's when it started to get difficult because he started having more physical issues.
Yeah.
Against Nicolas Jarry. He was down a set and break points, and then at about like 5-4 in the second set, he had to get treated on his left hamstring, and he got worked on. Like, it was scary. Like, the physio was like literally like digging into his hamstring. Like, he just, you know, he wasn't really, like, you could tell it was like kind of bothering him for a little while, but then he just pulled off like some insane shots. It was like he just went to a whole nother gear. And Jarry just became more and more and more deflated. Jarry is like a really big server. He moves pretty well from the ground. He used to be like top 40, but then he had a doping ban and he was out for 11 months. And then now he's like finally starting to play good again and like just kind of race through his competition. He beat Baez in the quarters. But holy crap. There was this ridiculous shot that Alcaraz hit to break in the third set. Where he was just running corner to corner, and then there was that passing shot, and you couldn't even see him because he was out of the frame. He was literally like hitting he was literally next to the scoreboard or the time clock.
It was like a Nadal type of passing shot that's just like right from the bleachers, and he just kind of goes and just like hits the shot from like way out in the back, and it's just
this is maybe the shot of the year.
Perfect. Yeah.
Like, in that moment, I was like, holy crap. Like, did he just do that?
Yeah.
And like, I had to see the replay, and like the replays, none of the replays were good until they finally put it on YouTube where it said like Alcaraz from all angles. And then I was actually like able, like this morning I saw that video and I was like, oh, okay, that's next level. And then he ended up winning 6-0, but I was a little concerned going into the Nori match because Cameron Nori is like the definition of like unflappable when it comes to never getting tired.
Yeah.
Like, he's just literally like, his lungs are like special, right? He's like,
if you were muscular like Martin Fucsovics, you would say he's like the Mario Sakkari of the ATP tour.
Yeah, because he can just run and run and run, and never gets tired. And he himself had so many long matches, like three setters. He went 7-6 in the third against Bernabe Zapata Morales in the semis, and he lost sets before that. And he just lost to Alcaraz last week in Buenos Aires. But here he is again in the final, just puts himself there. He's a lot more. Like, he's won more matches than anyone on tour now. He's 18-3 this year. And he's beaten Nadal. He's beaten at the ATP Cup. He beat Nadal, Fritz, and Dimonor. He made the final of Auckland, lost to Gasquet. He lost a tight match to Lehechka in the third round of Australian Open. And now he's just made these back-to-back finals. And on clay, it's very unusual for a Brit to do well.
Oh yeah,
like, this was the first time that two players are meeting in back-to-back finals since Djokovic and Murray in 2016, Madrid and Rome.
Yeah.
So it's been that long. It's been 7 years since we've had two players like that meet back-to-back. But I was concerned for Alcaraz because I just felt like Norrie was just gonna be a problem. Like he's gonna really test Alcaraz's shot tolerance, and it just wasn't there really. Like this whole week, the first set was very scrappy between these two. It was not a good quality first set. Alcaraz made 20 unforced errors, and he still somehow won it because like Norrie played some bad points.
Yeah,
at 5-6 in the
set. I think Norrie's a really good two matches for Alcaraz to play, like coming back from injury, and hopefully he doesn't get out again because of injury, but because of his like crazy difference in like the styles of the shots that he plays. Like it's night and day on the backhand and the forehand, and the fact that he's a lefty,
that's why he's so good on clay, because he has that loopy forehand that can push players back. He can find Alcaraz's backhand when he's in that cross court rally. But I do think Alcaraz has the edge in the forehand to backhand cross court, because his backhand stays low, but it's not like heavy enough to really do much, but it keeps him in the point, because it keeps it, it's awkward, and it's like very bunty. It doesn't really have like a full stroke. It's very like, it's like a half take back.
Yeah, he kind of almost just sort of like pushes it back in, like in a way, like it's not necessarily like a
full... It's like a nudge as opposed to like a like a
full... and that's when like when he gets in trouble, like when Norrie gets to like play some shots that are a little bit more like closer to the net, and he just kind of has to like, when players would normally like kind of backhand it, like with some toss pinches, go find the angle.
It's so flat. It's so flat.
He just sort of like puts it up there. And so the ball just sort of like gets over the net and just sort of sits there in a way. Because it's somewhere in between his lice and the.
It actually has underspin. It actually has underspin. Like it's curving inside the court.
Yeah.
As you're hitting. It's like the opposite of topspin. Like whatever the opposite is, like. It's but he can also find ridiculous angles with it, like when he's running.
Yeah.
So that's like that's why he's good on grass. That's why he's good on like he's
And that's the hand eye coordination, right? So he can actually find the shots, but he can just kind of like place the ball there, like wherever he wants to do. But yeah, I think it's good for Alcaraz to play like a guy like him, especially with the forehand that Norrie has, because as you said, like the backhand was not necessarily like Alcaraz's best shot like this week, but.
This was an amazing match to watch because I learned some more things about Alcaraz. Like, I already knew Norrie was never going to give up, not going to go away. He's going to have, you know, like an extra gear because he's like, he's just now he has so much experience. He's played so many finals. And like, he's always going to be tough for Alcaraz. But then Alcaraz goes up 7-5-3-0. And Norrie is serving at love 3, love 30. And they play this amazing point where like Alcaraz gets all these smashes back. And then Norrie hits like a really difficult overhead, lets it bounce from the baseline and puts it away for a winner. And then you could see like Alcaraz was starting to feel something, like a little injury, like he was stretching his hamstring and his thigh. Like it was after that point, but like, I didn't really notice it that much because he was still like he, you know, Norrie held and then he was serving at 3-1. And then he kind of played like a, like he kind of got over eager on some shots and Norrie broke back. And I was like, okay, this is going to get more complicated. But then at 2-3, after Norrie held, when Alcaraz served at 3-all, he served and volleyed on 3 of the first 4 points. And then he went for a first ball drop shot. And the commentators were like, okay, there's definitely something wrong.
Yeah.
Because now he's trying to finish points quickly and he's just trying to get out of the court as fast as he possibly can. And Cam Norrie is the worst player that you can play when you're physically compromised. Like, the worst. It's like Cam Norrie, like Medvedev, like players like that, like, you're toast if you're like struggling physically normally. And Alcaraz like just was kind of on one leg because every time he had to stretch and defend to his backhand, he was going for a drop shot or he was hitting like lethal forehands where he was just crushing shots. Yes. In the next game where he broke back after Norrie went up 4-3 and won 4 games in a row, Alcaraz was doing the Roger Federer saber. He was coming in. He was coming in on returns and trying to finish points at net, and it actually worked. Like, he actually broke back. And I was like, okay, he has, like, he can do this. He can do saber. He can crush forehands. Like, what can't he do right now? And he's hitting these ridiculous, like, he's still in this match somehow. Without even, like, without, like, and then after that, he had to get his hamstring taped. And then there was this long, like, session with the physio. He got, like, it all, like, heavily strapped. Like, similar to how Djokovic had his strapped in the Australian this year. It was like that for Alcaraz. And he just had it, like, heavily strapped. It was like, and his team at the beginning of the third set because he ended up losing that set. They were like, just don't play. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. You're in Acapulco next week. You're in Indian Wells. Pull out of Acapulco, first of all.
Yeah,
don't play really, that.
Seriously, yeah.
And then, you know, otherwise you're just going to make this thing worse. But Alcaraz was like, no, like, I'm going to play. I'm going to finish this match. I'm a fighter. Like, I got this. And, like, I'm not criticizing him. Like, you know, he very reasonably, like, he almost won this match. But so it was just amazing to see, like, that kind of, like, him just throwing the kitchen sink and Nori, like, just refusing to go away. And he went up 2-love. And the Alcaraz went up 2-love, 30-15 in the third.
Yep.
Nori breaks back because Alcaraz can't sustain this. He's playing an unsustainable brand of tennis right now. He's just going for broke.
Yeah.
At some point, it's not going to work. Like, you know, you're hitting, like, he's able to pull it off because A, he's just ridiculously talented. He can pull off shots that no one else can.
Yeah. But
and he has, like, insane racket head speed on his forehand. Yeah.
But it just so happens that, like, when you get to a point where, like, your game is, like, high risk, high reward, like, you cannot just reap the rewards all the time. There is going to be, otherwise it wasn't high risk.
If he was actually moving, you know, he'd have other options. Like, he'd be able to defend. He'd be able to, like, you know, like, his game is just more, it's just more complete. And I think he would have found a way through this match.
And to be fair, I feel like in terms of, Nori is going to run all day, but I think Alcaraz fit runs all day as well. Like, he's just as fast as anybody, and he's incredibly fit.
I just worry about the physicality now, because that's, you know, since the US Open, like, since he spent 24 hours on court there, then getting injured, then having the ab injury, then he had another injury that he had before the Australian Open.
Yeah.
Now he's got this, and I don't know how serious this is. I expect him to pull out of Acapulco, but now I'm worried he might not even be able to play Indian Wells.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, he really pushed himself, like, today. It was not, you know, and there was this one game, Bastian put it on Twitter, where Alcaraz just, like, hit four straight winners to break back. And I was just laughing. Like, how is he able to do this? Like, he was hitting return winners, and then he was hitting, like, 105-mile-per-hour forehands, like, without even moving. It was, like, it was a joke.
Yeah.
I was like, how is he doing? But, like, it was unsustainable, because...
Yeah. It's like that forehand that he hit, that clipped the line. He was just literally limping towards the ball. And just,
no,
like,
he was way out of position. He was not in balance at all.
Yeah, and he lapped the forehand. It was just like, how do you get so much speed out of that?
And then the umpire come down and it was in, but, like, Nori pointed to a different mark. And everyone's, like, going on calling him a cheater on Twitter and all that. I wouldn't go that far. I'll just say that it was, you know, in that moment, like, maybe he didn't see it or whatever, the mark or whatever, but, you know, that ball was in and it caught the line. And it still didn't really matter, because then, like, he still lost his serve at 5-1, and then Nori finally finished it off.
Yeah.
But, whew, that match was a roller coaster. It wasn't the highest quality, but boy, did it have the drama.
Yeah.
And boy, did we learn that Alcaraz even, like, compromised and not even 50% of his physical best is dangerous.
I do hope that he's able to get back to full fitness. I don't know if it just kept like day, like when he was doing, like, his off season, but obviously, like, it was just, I do hope that he gets back to it. I don't know. I have high hopes. I feel like if he were, like, well, I hope that he
wasn't so serious. Like, in this game, I still feel like he can get more disciplined. He can still work on the first serve.
Oh yeah,
he can still improve his shot tolerance. Because, like, some of these matches, like, I feel like they're just, like, he's almost like, because he has the game to beat these players 3-3, 3-2, 3-4, get out of there quickly. But all of these matches suddenly become adventurous, and you go on these coasters, and you're just like, do you really need to lose a set here? Like, do you really need to, like?
Yeah, I mean, especially this week. I do wonder if a part of it is just kind of, like, lack of practice. Playing.
That's why I like that he played these two tournaments, because, like, this is still a pretty good result, like, final and then winning last week. And for Nori, it's even better. Like, Nori, this is such a smart decision that he made, because he played Davis Cup on clay and then he just stayed here in South America, and then just now he racked up 550 points and he's number three in the race.
And also, like, I think in terms of Alcaraz's discipline, I think we have to remind ourselves that he's only 19 years old. All the things that he's been able to accomplish, he's been the youngest ever to do like a couple of things already in his lifetime. So I think that because he's been number one, because he had the season that he's had, it's easy to forget, like, just how little experience he actually has on tour. So So I feel like,
I mean,
I feel like
he's already made 10 finals. He's already won 7 titles.
Yeah.
He's won 2 Masters. He's won a Slam. He's been number one for 20 weeks.
Yeah.
He's 19. Like,
yeah. Year end number one, mind you.
Yeah.
So and yeah,
he beat Djokovic, Nadal, and Zverev to win a 1,000.
Yeah, I think Alcaraz is going to get there to the point where he's going to be able to maximize his game. And I think it would be really surprising if he didn't. We can never really rule out that something might happen. Yeah. Like we
it's
are
the
obviously
for me. I think I worry more about that than the
And first of all, like nobody is saying that Alcaraz is going to be the 20 Grand Slams, 22, 23 Grand Slam record. It's simply absurd to think that anybody is going to do that, especially when he's only 1-1. So, like, by the time that he gets to, if he needs to beat at least like the 10 Grand Slams before we actually start thinking about like any other
record. Get the second one, because we've seen players that kind of they win their first, and then like even Novak, you know, he won his first in 2008, and then he didn't win another since until 2011.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting because now he's like the hunted.
Yeah.
Last year, everything was new and he just like sort of rose to the top. But now he has all the expectations and pressure.
Exactly. And when you get to, I think a really good, reasonable way to thinking of like a good player that he's going to make there, you know, there's more part of history is that I think it's reasonable to say like maybe Alcaraz wins like 4 to 5 Grand Slams. I think that's like a solid number. Like, but.
Yeah,
but
it's just like we can't predict the longevity. We can't predict the injuries.
Yeah,
and then you know, like, you also don't learn that much, like from these 2 weeks, from a standpoint of like the opposition, I guess, because like the opposition is like good, like on clay, like these players, like they're formidable, like in terms of, like, you know, sort of 50 to 75 in the world type. But it's going to be interesting when he's at Indian Wells, and he's playing, you know, consecutively like against top players.
I feel like Alcaraz is we're gonna need to have like a mid-season brief on how Alcaraz has been playing, like just to sort of gauge like where he's at now, because he played like a full good season last year. He played, I think, I'm not even sure he played like a full season on the ATP tour back in 2021.
Basically like from Wimbledon to the end of the year. Before that, he was still playing challengers.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like by post Wimbledon, I think we're going to be able to like say like, okay, where's Alcaraz at? So,
yeah. But he's already had like, I think because after the French, he had an injury. He didn't train on grass. Then he came into Wimbledon kind of injured. After the US Open, he got injured again.
Yeah.
And he got injured again in the offseason after recovering from the abdominal. And then he had to miss the Australian Open after already missing ATP Finals and Davis Cup.
Yeah.
And now he's in doubt for Indian Wells in Miami and probably pulling out of Acapulco. So
probably should have pulled out of the Davis Cup last year.
Oh, yeah, after the US Open, too. Yeah. He played the Davis Cup. That was strange. But, yeah, I mean, I guess you learn and you move on and, there's a lot to admire about this guy, and he brings a lot more. He's just so fun to watch in all respects. But
yeah. Also, as you remember from the very beginning of the podcast, there was a final going on, and this just in: Camila Giorgi won in 3 sets.
Rebecca Peterson,
yeah,
in the final, and she had a really good week. She beat Siniakova, Stephens, Sharif. They were all seated 6-2 and 4.
Didn't she give like a six love?
Yeah, I was just going to talk about that. That was quite something, because I saw the highlights of that, and Georgie was playing well, and she was hitting the ball big first strike tennis, like kind of how like she played when she won in Montreal, like kind of that same style. But Stephens, that was just shocking.
Oh yeah, it was Stephens'
performance. Like, it was really, really lackluster. Like, she wasn't moving her feet. She looked kind of disinterested, like was kind of reaching for shots, like the, like just no adjustment whatsoever. It was really kind of surprising that from a major champion, like she wasn't able to win even one game. And it was very quick, like it was 48 minutes or something for Georgie. Very surprising. Also because Stephens plays very well in the Mexico. She's won titles here before, and Stephens has never gotten back to that 2017, 2018 level, like when she won the US Open made the Miami final and made the Roland Garros final. No, she won Miami, actually. She won Miami and she won the US Open. And she finished, she made the final of the WTA finals and she made the final of Canada Masters. So she actually had a very good year in 2018. But since then, we have not seen, apart from a couple of quarterfinal runs and a couple of titles in Mexico, we haven't really seen Stephens back at that level.
Yeah. And on the other hand, Georgie is like one of those players. She's in the...
I have no idea what to expect from Georgie.
Exactly. Honestly, for me, she's like in the same category as in Ostapenko with like a lower level in which that like she will either play tennis that will beat essentially anybody on tour, or she will play a kind of tennis that is going to beat herself. And I think Ostapenko has a better chance of beating everybody on tour than Georgie, but I feel like those days could even still come for her as well. It's just, she's always been that way. And I think that she's bound to win a couple of titles here and there. So I think that doesn't necessarily surprise me all that much to see Georgie
win. I don't know how much we can really take away from it in terms of like sustaining it, but yeah, I guess congratulations to her. She won another title.
Yep, her fourth career title.
Wow. And also congratulations to Hubie Hurkacz, who won his sixth title in Marseille. And he defeated, in the final, he beat Benjamin Bonzi. Benjamin Bonzi made his second ATP final this week. He beat Alex de Minaur, and then he beat the young Arthur Fils, who is really talented. He's 18 years old. He's got a really fun and exciting game as well. But that was a good week for Hurkacz because he was the number one seed. He was expected to win. It's indoors. He has a big serve. He had to save match point against Michael Emer in the quarterfinals. That was the third set tiebreak. He was 6-5 down in the third set tiebreak, saved a match point, got out of that match, and then beat his good friend Alexander Bublik. Bublik smashed, Bublik got over his 10-match losing streak. And he beat Dimitrov in the quarters. I actually saw the third set tiebreak of the Dimitrov-Bublik match. And that one was... like, it was good for Bublik to get another win against Dimitrov. He now has a 3-2 head-to-head against him. And they're good. They know each other well. But Dimitrov had 2 match points. And on one of them, he kind of slipped as he was, like, trying to change directions and get a backhand back. And then he just didn't win another point after that.
No.
And I mean, had he won that point, he would have been in the semis against Hurkacz, a guy he's beaten 3 times. He has a 3-0 head to head. And he's won all their tie breaks. And Dimitrov has never gotten back to an ATP final since 2018 Rotterdam. So it's been over 5 years.
Yeah.
He's not made another final. And he keeps getting to semis. He's made 11 semis, but he's never won any of them. He's had some tough opponents like Nadal, Medvedev, Djokovic, a few other ones that he maybe should have won. But so I thought that was a bit of a tough loss for Dimitrov, but a really good week for Hurkacz. Because he badly needed to win another title, I think, and just kind of make himself relevant again.
He never really felt like he had any confidence in his game, like for a while now. So like I feel like
but he's always kind of done enough to be like 11 or 10 in the world. Like, you know, just kind of like, you know, maybe won a title. Like he won Halle last year. He went got to the finals of Canada, but his slam results weren't very good. And
because I feel like when Hurkacz is playing well, I feel like he can trouble anybody and beat the vast majority of players on tour.
Yeah.
So it's the, like
he's kind of like a Medvedev in terms of like he has a big serve and he moves really well and he defends well and he has a good backhand.
Yeah.
And I'd say like, he's more competent at the net than Medvedev is. He's very he has very good hands and volleys.
Yeah. I don't think well the I don't think that he
gets to pass it.
Yeah. I don't think that Hurkacz is. Backhand is better than Medvedev, but I feel like the one thing that Hurkacz does better is that like he has a more proper technique. He's cleaner, so like a little bit more topspin. So he has like a bit more even like I would say options. So but it's but just
the forehand. Like, the forehand is honestly maybe the worst forehand of anyone in the top 15.
Yeah,
what holds him back. Yeah.
To be fair, is that like I find that the problem with his forehand is not even the forehand itself. It's just the fact that he always somehow mistimes it. It's just something goes wrong with it.
It's a little better when he's like
raise errors back, all the time. Yeah,
like when he's hitting it as an approach shot or he's like trying to come in and hit a good volley, then he's like, you know, his forehand like can be precise.
Yeah,
but when he's way behind the baseline, then he can like just get really passive on that side, and he's a lot better on the backhand.
Yeah, a lot better.
But yeah, like, it was a good week for him. He won another title, and then try to continue his form. And then this week we have the return of Djokovic. Djokovic is now has 378 weeks at number one. He's surpassed Steffi Graf most of all time.
I think he will complete 378 weeks
Tomorrow.
On March 6th, I believe.
No. He was at 377 this week. So this week he tied.
And I think
tomorrow he's
let's just count together here. Because like he started his 374th week. He started it on January 30th.
When he won the Australian.
So
and now
like
it's been 4 weeks.
Four Mondays since then. Seven.
So now he's at 370. So like
he completed 374 weeks on Monday the 6th. So he's starting his 378th week.
Yeah, today, but he'll have the whole week. Like he'll have
it
for the whole
he
week.
He will have it, but it's just like in terms it's just like he will break it. It's not something that can be undone at this
point. It was interesting because if Alcaraz had won Rio, they would have been tied in ranking.
Would have been tied.
But Djokovic would still be number one because of the points at the slam level and the 1000 level.
Yeah. I thought it was really interesting how like the timing of it was perfect for the ATP tour because they had just last year they pulled out like the live rankings on and now like obviously like all the crazy tennis fans would even be following the live rankings before that, but now that the ATP has it, they actually were supposed to like put up a article saying what would happen in that situation. Because and I had no idea, honestly. Like I didn't even do my research. I kind of just
It's not common. It's it doesn't really happen.
Oh yeah, absolutely not.
I don't remember the last time.
Yeah, and I did the lazy thing, and I just kind of like asked Twitter, like if that was something instead of like looking, and it's like, lo and behold, it's like the article right on the ATP Tour website explaining what happens.
Oh yeah.
But yeah.
But yeah, and then so now Djokovic is back this week in Dubai. Yeah, and then Medvedev is there and Felix is there. It's like kind of the same field as Doha, but just with Djokovic in it.
Yeah.
And it's a 500 and he's won it like six times. Like him and Federer, they always own that tournament. Federer's won it eight times. He's won it five times.
I don't see anyone winning this tournament other than Djokovic. Hopefully Medvedev like plays well as well, but like I feel like he might be getting tired at this point. But
he could get to it. And then obviously Rublev is the second seed. Rublev has been kind of like struggling a little bit in these best of three matches. He beat Griekspoor this week, and then he lost to Lehechka.
Yeah,
he saved match points against Griekspoor.
Mm.
So it's kind of crazy because he has five wins this year, and in two of those five he saved match points.
And Griekspoor reached the semifinals in Rotterdam as well, like last week. So it's been
he won a title.
Yeah,
there's players like that right now that you wouldn't expect. If you look at the race, it's like, whoa, what is Ben Shelton doing there? What is, you know, like in terms of like there's just new names that you wouldn't see in the race, maybe at earlier stages this year. But then like Nadal is going to be out of the top 10, and like Alcaraz is like kind of a question mark.
Yeah, he hasn't made any announcements about Indian Wells right so far.
Yeah,
but if. And I think it's about like a 95% chance that he doesn't play Indian Wells. So, yeah, we're going to have to cap his weeks at top 10, I think at 913.
Yeah. So I put out the stat during the Australian Open because Linda Fruportova got to the fourth round.
Hmm.
And Rafael Nadal has been consecutively in the top 10 longer than Linda Fruportova's entire lifetime by a week. It's like 920 weeks. Like basically half his life, like 2005, April 2005 till now. It's like half the time that he's been alive. He's been a top 10 player. Nadal's 36.
And no, like, but like who is the guy that has been alive for almost less time than
No. I'm saying Nadal has been like top 10 for half his life, and he's been top 10 longer than the entire lifetime of Linda Fruportova.
Oh, yeah. Linda Fruportova.
She's 18, like she's born in 2005.
Isn't that crazy? Like, I mean, it is obviously going to change, but like Linda Fruvitova is like, she was born and Nadal was in the top 10.
Yeah.
And she's there and Nadal's still in the top 10. It's just,
it's so wild to think about because it's like, and he's always like done so well on clay that even when he's had these injuries, he does like, he builds up so many points in the first half of the year. that even when he goes on these long hiatuses, he's just like pretty much secure in the top 10. It's like pretty insane. But
yeah, this podcast will have to wait until Nadal gets back so that we can talk about him again, because we've covered a lot of ground today, and it's time.
It's pretty good. Pretty good. We got through quite a bit. Yeah. It was fun to watch this week, and then like next week.
Golden Swing. Essentially over, because we're not on clay anymore. Acapulco's on hard, but
Acapulco, Dubai, and then you got Austin, Monterey on WTA, and then you got Santiago. I guess that's going to be a continuation. I guess team will play there again in Santiago, and then you have Musetti as the top seed, and Baez and those other players besides Nori and Alcaraz.
Yeah,
but yeah, we'll be kind of interesting, but then it doesn't stop. We go straight to Indian Wells 2 weeks, then Miami that's 2 weeks, crazy. And then we just go to the clay. It's basically going to be nonstop tennis from now
until the U.S. Open,
the end of Wimbledon, and then maybe then after that we have a little bit of a break.
After the Wimbledon, we have like a week.
You have like Hamburg, Umag, Newport, and then you sort of have like you have a mini clay swing, unless like Alcaraz decides to play that, and then everyone's like, you know, suddenly like last year he played that, and it wasn't a quiet time. Like it was Alcaraz was there, team was there, other top players were like.
We do have a bit of a mini break between that and the North American hardcore season.
I mean, next week will be the return of Casper Ruud, so that will be after his off season in February. But yeah, it's about time we get an off season for our day, Andre, because it's been a long one, and it was a pleasure being here and covering it all.
All right.
Shout out to Owen as well, who's in Australia.
And he's enjoying
doing a semester abroad.
Yeah. Enjoying the summer in Australia after enjoying the Australian Open in Australia, obviously. But all right. We miss you, Owen. Getting back.
Yeah. We'll definitely have Owen on again.
Yeah. Well, I'll talk to you later, and we'll be on Twitter. You can follow Punch at PunchP2K. Owen, you can follow him at Tennis Nation. The podcast is at Tennis and Bagels, and me for like other stuff than sometimes tennis, sometimes not, at Rollenberg Andre. And we'll see you next time. See ya.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.